ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्याज्ञनं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रं मात्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरूपरीं माथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दन् गिरिवरं महो राधिकमधावशम् प्राप्तो यस्या प्रतीतकृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालयते निराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजिमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि अनर्पितचरिं चिरत्करुणयावतीर्णाकलहं समार्पयितुमुन्नतज्वलरासं सुभक्तिश्रियं हरिपुरतसुन्दराद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये खन्दरे स्फुरतो वासठिनन्दन अजानुलम्बितभुजो कनकावदत् सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्षु विश्वम्बरोद्यावरो जुगधर्मपालो वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो लादिनीशक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमोऽस्तुते हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धदीनाबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशगोपीककान्तराधाकान्त नमोऽस्तुते राधे वृन्दवनादिशे करुणमृतवाहिनि कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम् भक्त्या विहीनायापराधलक्षये क्षिप्ताश्चाकमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम् वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम् श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय श्री श्री गौर गदाधर जी की जय श्री श्री राधा मदन मोहन जी की जय श्री रघुविंद देव की जय राधा गोपीनाथ जी की जय गौर भक्त वृंद की जय गौर प्रमाण हरि हरि बोल So, pranam to all of you. Good morning from again Buenos Aires. And again, here we are for a second meeting of Ishtagosti or questions and answers, or questions and further questions, and further reflections, and further turning of the ocean of Krishna consciousness, which is in itself oceanic in nature. That's why Srila Rupa Goswami, when he composed his monumental work on bhakti, which is another word for Krishna consciousness, Krishna bhakti, he wrote Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So he said, okay, this monumental work is just but a droplet from that ocean. And we pray to be sprinkled by that. But that single drop, that will be more than enough for the day and enough. More enough, more than enough for the lifetime. So it's an ocean, bottomless ocean with unending layers of depth and breadth. So that's a blessing in itself. But also that can be tricky in the sense of dealing with something which is bottomless in both breadth and depth. We can get lost in that, or we can, how to say, sometimes, and who is free from that? I'm not. Engage in this, indulge in this temptation of like limiting the bottomless ocean, limiting the breadth and the depth and the possibilities of the ocean. So here we are trying to remind each other how bottomless the ocean is, so to say, how bottomless Krishna consciousness is, and how much. There is to be excavated, and how much every single conclusion we may have reached in terms of Krishna bhakti as we always say, may be accurate, but it can be always more accurate. May speak about the nature of God, about the nature of reality, but there is no limit to how much more we can say about it, to how much more we can grow together in exploring, and exploring reality, and exploring the heart of God, and exploring our potential in connection to the divine love. So again, Ishtagoshti is ideally a humbling, should be a humbling experience for all of us, in which we once again witness, hopefully have some sort of epiphany of how bottomless this ocean is, of how endless is our prospect, is our potential, and how much open we should remain in that connection. I have started to read again one book from Srila Siddhar Maharaj called Encounters with Divinity. And there he mentioned, as he mentioned many times, this idea of the closer you get to the infinite, the more overwhelmed you will become, because the more you will realize there is no limit to making progress. The more you will realize you can just touch one point of an infinite, but the infinite is always infinite. So it's a the closer you get, and that's why the subjective experience, he was saying that yesterday, I was reading that those who get closer and closer to the infinite somehow will subjectively experience this paradoxical feeling that I'm getting farther and farther. That's why Mahaprabhu, I mean, he was the very personification of divine love. And he will say things like, Na prema gandhasti darapi haro. In me, there is not even the scent of divine love. But nobody showed divine love more than him. So he was the one who had divine love the most. And he will be the one who mostly expressed his lack of divine love. Because that's the unavoidable subjective experience of getting in touch with the bottomless substance. You realize how much more you can have it, how much more or you can be possessed by it. So you can never claim I have it. You can never claim I know it. We will never reach be so sure about expressing ourselves with that level of assertiveness in connection to the divine realm. That's why Mahaprabhu himself will say amani nama nadina, which entails this idea of unassertiveness in connection to the unlimited possibilities of divine love. So again, this is not a gathering, so we get together and just affirm in an arrogant way our certainties. No, and became more and more convinced that we already know everything perfectly and we have all the absolute knowledge and the perfect understanding, and there's nothing else to be learned, and just the only thing that remains is to make others know what we already perfectly know. But actually, it's a meeting to humble ourselves and to remind ourselves of our eternal prospect of eternal discipleship and eternal life of students. So, again, something that is coming to my mind, just an initial inspiration after Mangalacharan, that I always like to say is the most important part of Harikatha, because Mangalacharan means praying both speaker and listeners, so to say, to be instruments and not to be to engage in what we may call transpersonal or trans-egoic sharing, where I don't try to be the main character, any of us, but the divine flow, the divine descent, the divine current of inspiration, hopefully, is the main operative force here, both for me and for you over there. It's a teamwork. We need grace. So Mangalacharan is that crucial moment that, although it lasts a few minutes, it's the one which determines what will happen in the next hour, an hour and a half. So that said, and before we go to questions that you may have, I would like to begin by sharing a few words in connection to our meeting from the last week, and in connection to one particular answer I tried to give, or some thoughts I shared in connection to one question shared by, I thought her name was Anutam Chitra from Chennai. In connection to preaching, prachar, book distribution, and so on. Since throughout that day and the days that followed, I received different messages and communication with different devotees, and although many appreciated the answer and felt nourished by it, some others who also appreciated the answer and felt nourished by it also got a sense that it felt like I was kind of minimizing book distribution or Prabhupada himself by extension, or even sometimes mocking at this whole situation. Not that I was doing that, but some of them had that experience. So of course I would like to share a few words to clarify just in case that that's not my that was not my intention and that's not my feeling. As I mentioned in my answer, I have been a book distributor myself, and I very lovingly cherish those memories, and I'm a book author myself now, so I'm still engaged with these dynamics of writing and distributing books. So I have nothing against books, against reading them, distributing them, writing them. I'm totally in for that. But something that I would like to emphasize is that whatever I said in that answer, and of course the answer is there for all of us, for all of you to listen to again. It's important that whatever, not only me, but whatever anyone replies to any given question is understood in context. And context in this case means which was the answer. No, I mean I gave some reply, but their reply was in reply to an answer to a question, sorry. The question was from someone who was saying, as you may recall, that she was in certain particular community dynamics where book distribution was kind of almost imposed as the highest service, and somehow with a sense of whomever is not engaging in that service is not engaged in the highest service. And the person who presented the question was also somehow expressing some potential discouragement in that connection, because she and probably many others, because I've heard this so many times, may feel inclined to do other services or inspire for that or have some capacities for that. But if they are not engaged in the highest service, so to say, somehow this creates this discouragement or this kind of even like caste system or elite thing or hierarchy. And my main point, my whatever I said in reply, again, going back to the content, was addressing that particular angle of vision, that particular perspective, which was book distribution. No, book distribution is not the highest service. But the point is, the highest service is not any given particular action, but from which place we do whatever we do. That's the highest service. The highest service is anyavilasita sunyam jnana karmadhyana brihatam anukulyana krishnanu shilanam bhaktirutama. That's the definition that Rupa Goswami gives of uttam bhakti, or topmost devotion that we are expected to embrace as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. That's the highest service, whatever form it takes. That's my main point. Whatever you happen to be doing in that spirit, described by Rupa Goswami, that we call highest service. Not that doing something is the highest and not doing something is the lowest. Because again, nobody's distributing books in the spiritual world. So that means that they are not doing the highest service. If we have this idea, no? I mean, the spiritual world is the realm of the highest service, and nobody is distributing books there. With this, I'm not bashing book distribution. I'm just saying, what do we understand? Which are our own ideas about what's highest, what's lowest? Because sometimes we may be quite simplistic and just put a label of some activity as the highest and something else as not highest without caring. But which is the inner attitude through which we are engaging in that. And that's the only thing that Krishna is taking into consideration. Bhava, your inner world. Whether you are given a book, whether you're given a class. And of course, again, as we mentioned, Prabhupada may have said many times, book distribution is the highest thing, but also he said many times, Varnashram is the most important thing, taking care of the devotees is the most important thing. Becoming a pure devotee of Krishna is the most important thing. So there are many most important things that Prabhupada established. So we have to, again, be open and be able to integrate all these differences of not opinion, but difference statements given in at different moments in particular contexts. Because as I like to say, a text without a context becomes a pretext. And we can justify anything and everything by quoting or understanding things outside of its context. So again, my main point in my reply last week, just with to wrap up and conclude this clarification, was to emphasize the, in one sense, the relativity of any particular action and the absolute importance of the inner spirit of that action for it to be actual bhakti, for it to be, as I say, prachar. I try to speak about prachar. Without achar, is PR, public relationships. So at the end of the day, my main point was not so much to dismiss any given activity, but to emphasize the inner spirit of the activity and how that's what Krishna takes, that what pleases Krishna. And that's the highest service, so to say. Highest is not a worthiness contest, so to say, or a meritocracy, or an egoic competition. Like, I want to be engaged in the highest thing. I mean, what's highest for each person, that will be different, subjectively even. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, every devotee feels that their connection with Krishna is the highest, and everyone is correct. So we have to harmonize that. And of course, at the end of my reply last week, and with this I conclude, I also remind that I myself shared, in my opinion, what will be the highest perspective of prachar or preaching, like was in the context of let's help Mahaprabhu to, how to say, pay his debt of love. Krishna is indebted with the love of Radha and the gopis, and now he's coming as Mahaprabhu trying to make devotees for Sri Radha. And preaching could be connected to that, recruiting servants for her and helping in this way Bhagavan to do something with the heavy depth of love he has attained and obtained. So again, I'm not against preaching, I'm not against prachar, I'm not against book distribution. I just try to answer the question in a certain context. Again, if someone maybe would have asked me, Maharaj, can you sing the glories of book distribution? Probably my reply would have been different. Because my reply would have been in reply to that particular question. All those, I'm sure some of the points I share, I will have also shared just to clarify which are my thoughts on that. But I wanted just to share this brief clarification because, of course, it's not my intention that anyone feels disturbed by thinking that we are here bashing such a holy, sacred engagement, what to speak of someone like Srila Prabhupada. And of course, again, the challenge of diversity is that we will find people with different takes and different levels of emphasis and different experiences and different opinions. And many of them may be correct at the same time simultaneously, no? So that's when we are invited to embrace the principle of tadatmya, to embrace the principle of empathy and taking the time to entering into the shoes of the other person and learning their perspective, learning the experiences they've gone through to reach that particular stance. And if that's bona fide or legal, so to say, learning to appreciate that and even to enrich our own position through that, and vice versa, of course, no? Not only expecting people to be empathic with me, but me to begin with, being willing to embrace that principle in relation to others. So anyhow, some initial clarification I want to share. Is the camera a little bit out of focus? I don't know why that's going on. That's a little better, I don't know. Okay.
A little
Yeah.
better. It's still blurry.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good.
Okay. So anyhow, some brief clarification. I hope that helps. And I'm ready if we have questions that anyone may have for today, some topic you may like that we elaborate in further detail. Bhakti Rasa mentioned you can raise your hand physically or digitally through the Zoom button. Okay, there is Anutam Chitra raising her hand. So please, you can unmute yourself, please.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, there was this one doubt. This doubt arose in context of a conversation I was having with my father. It was just a very casual conversation, and at some point he had mentioned that how long do you think I might be living? Probably another 10 years. So for a moment that shook me, and I was moved a little to tears. And at that point I sort of remembered how I was indeed attached to my significant other. But when we see scriptures and all, there is a lot of emphasis on how attachment can be the root cause of getting caught up in this cycle of birth and death, and how with the sword of detachment, one needs to sever such bondings. So when I sort of read that, it sounds a little impersonal to me, which sort of seems to contradict the value of personalism or radical personalism. Like, it seems two opposites, and I'm sort of struggling to harmonize or put both of these in perspectives. Like, there is attachment towards significant others seems quite natural, like almost a given, but then there's also this aspect. So how do we put that in context, Maharaj?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a classical one, that question. So thanks for bringing it up. That's maybe in the top five or something. The attachment, detachment, dichotomy, and how to harmonize what the scriptures say and what we feel, and our attempt to be aligned with scripture, which sometimes take us to suppress our emotions, not because scripture is proclaiming repression, but again, because probably we are misunderstanding the statements or taking them out of context. Not because Krishna himself, in the third chapter of the Gita, he's presenting a rhetorical question, which basically, where he basically says, what can be gained through repression? Well, like the idea being nothing. So that's important to bear in mind. Shastra is not promoting repression or emotional mental dysfunction, as I try to share in my book on radical personalism in the section of individuation and certain sections and how to deal with our psychology, our psychological landscape, emotional landscape. But again, still we have these statements on detachment, as you mentioned, detachment as the cause of all problems, and or Krishna himself in the Gita telling Arjuna, as you mentioned, okay, you take the sword of knowledge and cut this knot of attachment, and so on and so forth. So, what's detachment? What's attachment, and so on? No? Because sometimes again we take for granted some terms and we just use them, and take for granted what they mean, and lose nuance in the process of doing that. And in time, the more we use some term, taking it for granted, the more nuance it loses. And eventually, just the term has been reduced to one single unique possible thing without any possibility for context and nuance and different application. It just means this. So it's always very important that we keep these ideas in a more like flow state, so to say, not like fixed conclusive meaning. So for me, detachment, I like to describe detachment. Detachment is not indifference first, because sometimes we understand detachments as that. No, look, you should be detached from whatever, this situation or this person, and we translate that or add the subtitle to that as indifference or rejection or things like that, no? And detachment only basically means I like the symbology of this, and I gave that a few times. It's like if you have put your hand in your eye, so it's so close, my hand is so close to my eye that I cannot see it. No, that's attachment. No, it's so you are so much like enmeshed in the situation that you lose sight of what's actually going on. So I'm not seeing what's actually going on. I'm not seeing my hand. So for seeing, in order to see my hand, to appreciate the hand for what it is, I need to take some distance from my hand. Detachment. Detachment means distance, but not distance to stop being my to stop seeing my hand, but to start seeing my hand for what it actually is. So you follow. It's not a distance to avoid the thing. It's not a distance to reject the thing. It's not a distance to repress the thing. It's just enough distance to see the thing for what it is. Because I got too close, so to say, that I lost proper vision, proper objectivity, proper criterion to understand what's going on. So that's the idea of detachment, basically, in a practical sense. That don't be like drowning in a how to say in a whirlpool of emotions and dopamine. Be more objective. No, like of course, again, we can give the example of a romantic relationship. No, someone in this world may, I don't know, find their better half, so to say, and they will enter the honeymoon period, and that will be a period of intense over-idealization, so to say, of one another. There's not so much objectivity in those first weeks or months. And it's okay. There is place for that. I'm not condemning the honeymoon period. Maybe some of you are going through that now, so I don't want to spoil the whole thing. I'm a sannyasi, but I'm trying to regulate my sannyashood in these cases. But my point is, at one point you have to be grounded from that honeymoon period. You have to understand there are other things to consider in the connection between one another. No, in the beginning, you may be like extremely infatuated by the other person, and it's part of the process. But at other point, you need to get a little bit more detached. And again, but detached in this case, I'm saying, take a proper stance to properly understand what's going on, and it's not just a romantic movie 24/7. You have to be grounded and take more responsibility and acknowledge that the other person may have things that you don't like and you have to integrate and vice versa, and all these type of things that can be described as detachment in that sense. That's one way of explaining it. And of course, another way will be in connection to what we talked about last week when I thought there was this question. Nicholas was his name, I think. On ahamameti, of this sense of I and mine, which is exclusively based on a how to say on a separate sense of existence. No, when we are not considering God as the center, but we consciously or unconsciously we try to occupy that center, that throne. So everything we are seeing is in terms of me in the center. Everything that's going on around me converges in me. Like I'm the ultimate converging point of reality. That's what we call false ego. And that's not healthy. And from that, we need to get detached from. Because if from that viewpoint, I relate to my father or to whomever, I may get attached to him, but with me in the center and with me being the ultimate converging point. So that's the thing that is not recommended in the scriptures. That's what it is said, you get detached. It's not you get detached from your father. No, it's not like stop loving your father as you love him. It's just watch out for not making your father just an instrument and you being the ultimate converging point that every other person and relationships are there just to serve your own separate sweet, so-called sweet will. That's the main thing that is being like condemned, so to say, or we are being advised about. But it's not that you have to As we were, I remember we talked about this with Archana Siddhi when we did our podcast last year on she has worked many years with couples, grihastha communities, and trying to give advice on how to navigate those waters in a sustainable, healthy human way. And she told me, I remember, I mean, you cannot have a successful family if you don't get attached to your family. I mean, if you don't develop a sense of attachment on some level, there are levels of this. So you have to develop some attachment to your kids to the point that you feel they are my children, so you take proper care of them. Because if you are absolutely detached from your kids to the point that you don't feel they are my kids, that sense of I am my is not established, then you are not caring for them because they are not your kids. So you are not caring for feeding them and taking care of them because they are not yours. And again, you can use philosophy to justify everything. You know? So they are Krishna's kids, they are not mine. And I'm just surrendering to Krishna, and Krishna will be happy with this and he will take care of them. So I don't need to do that. And we can create a whole philosophical narrative to just be irresponsible, irresponsible. As a person. So again, you have to establish some attachment with this type of people. So we have this sense of there is a bond, there is a relationship, and there is a commitment in that relationship. Because if not, I will just neglect that. And that has happened a lot, she was telling me. I mean, throughout the history of grihastha couples. I mean, she shared with me this like shocking statistic, like almost like 90% of the grihastha couples of coming from Prabhupada disciples divorce themselves. That's a lot. That's almost 100%. That's another way of putting it. 90% is almost everyone. No? And she will tell me in big part it was because we had that this dysfunctional idea of detachment and being transcendental. And so many like derogatory ideas on women and so much violence and so much abuse. No need to enter into the details of that here now. But so my point is many of those things were done in the name of detachment. But Prabhupada himself says so many times, we are our practice is about attachment, not detachment. So getting attached to Krishna. And naturally, a sense of detachment will come from that attachment. First, you establish the perfect object of attachment and get attached to Bhagavan. And then, as a byproduct of that, detachment will come. That's the only detachment we will accept. It's not that we have to practice detachment as a separate anga, as a separate expression of bhakti. No, we need to embrace positively bhakti, the bhakti practice of singing and meditating and praying and sharing in sadhusang and so on. And that will create in itself the proper detachment that comes as a byproduct. It's not that we do detachment as a main practice and attachment to Krishna comes as a byproduct. It's exactly the opposite. But I cannot tell you how many times I met devotees who have the exact wrong idea, the exact opposite idea. They were like, the more detached I am, I become, the more I will love Krishna, we get closer to him. And it's like, no, it's exactly the opposite. And I explained that quote in the Bhagavatam and they were shocked. So yeah, we have to be personal, we have to be affectionate with others. But also again, in our particular worldview as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we try to establish connection with people on the basis of this non-dual foundation that where we acknowledge everything is connected with the center, Sambandha, everything is connected with the center. So what to whomever I'm relating, they are related to the center. They are related to Krishna. Everything is connected to Krishna. So that awareness is important in how we relate to one another, because if we forget this again, we may gradually slip into us trying to occupy that center. And that's when it becomes a problem. That when whatever attachment we have becomes like excessive. It's not that every form of attachment is wrong, because if not, we enter into these black and white scenarios. No, all attachment is bad, all attachment is good, or whatever. If you are attached to your father, that's bad. If you are detached, that's good. And we need both. I mean, we need to be attached on some level, as I mentioned, but also we need this detachment that gives this perspective and distance and bigger picture. So actually we need both in their right amount, instead of which of the two are you picking on 100%. So once again, we have to become more and more accustomed to conceive of reality and to conceive of Christian consciousness of our life as nuanced, and things are generally not happening in black and white terms, no, but gray. Gray should be a favorite color of ours. So some thoughts that comes to my mind. I hope that that helps. Anutam Chitra, thank you for your question.
Yes, Maharaj. Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you. So Bhakti Rasa has her hand raised.
It's in relation to your response to Anutam Chitra. Is I was reflecting on what you were saying, and it seems also that we can apply the same thing to like our thoughts and our ideas. Like to be, I was just thinking that our thoughts can be too close to us, and we can't even see them when we don't separate. If we don't give some distance between ourselves and our ideas, or ourselves and our thoughts, everything that you were saying regarding another person could also be applied to our own thoughts. Because you know, sometimes it's said also, oh, you shouldn't, don't think, you know, that's like, it's kind of like also negating relationships. It's very, very, very similar. If we're too attached or too detached, we don't have a proper perspective.
Yeah. So that was not a question. You said it all, Dr. Rasa.
Yes,
but if that's a few words that come to my mind, Justin, like this is an extended reply to Anutam Chitra's question. Yeah, we have to also be careful of, again, not going to the extremes, not to the extreme of do not think, because, I mean, to begin with, that's not possible. So imagine you try to not do something that is not possible. Try to imagine the train wreck that means. No, like you cannot not think, but someone tells you you shouldn't be thinking, so you try to make the best not to think, or the same idea, no, like don't feel anything for your father, and you cannot but feel something. Is that person is your father, you love him, so but you try to not do that, so that's really dysfunctional. So that's one extreme, but the other extreme is also we take our own thoughts too seriously, or we become too overly identify with them. No? Like my thoughts, my ideas about everything, it's me. And that's not necessarily the case. No? And that can be one of the main things getting in the way of us practicing spiritual life from a mystical place, so to say. Because bhakti actually is a mystical school, is a mystical experience, something that goes beyond mind and thoughts. In one sense, Krishna is adokshaya. He lies beyond our ideas, so to say. Now, Krishna lies beyond our ideas about him. Now, our ideas about God do not equal God. I say we spoke recently in New Zealand about that. We can have so many ideas about everything, but they can be just ideas. That doesn't mean they are an actual experience, an actual realization. And we have to be careful. I mean, it's impossible not to have ideas, and it's great to have ideas, but also we should be careful not to become addicted to whatever ideas we may be having at present moment. I mean, it's good to always have ideas, but just be careful not to be overtly attached to a particular set of ideas. Because, and I remember talking with Richard Rohr, he will tell that, you know, like people, it's addicted to different things, to substances and to different patterns and emotional denial and so many things. And some are attached to one thing, some are attached to other. But he will say that if there is one single thing that almost everyone, all of us are attached to, it's we are attached to our thoughts, to our way of thinking, to our way of seeing, filtering reality. And he will recall this research that I shared a few times, which says, on a very good day, we are only willing to question 5% of our ideas. And that's on a really beautiful, shiny Sunday, so to say. No? 5%, which again, all amounts almost to 0% in this case. So that speaks, in general, of course, that's a statistic. I'm not saying each one of you is in that situation, but that speaks for itself about sometimes we are attached to our ideas. And they are so much ingrained and so much like embedded into our lenses through which we filter reality. And again, I'm not saying this pointing at anyone. I'm including myself first in the list that I'm talking about. That's the teaching of the scriptures. That's in the Yoga Sutras as well. I mean, we have certain samskaras. We have acquired impressions. That means samskaras from time without beginning. So we have acquired different samskaras, which basically color the way we see reality, no? And make us to perceive things from a particular angle, from a certain perspective, with a certain mood. But again, that doesn't mean that's how ultimate reality looks like. That's how we are looking at reality from our particular perspective, which is I'm not canceling that. I'm just saying that's not the all in all. And maybe in our own case in time, we'll gaze at reality from a different point of view. What to speak of other people having other points of view. Even ourselves will change the way we are seeing the same thing from different perspectives. So the important thing is that we are willing to shift perspective, to embrace paradigm shift. Because if not, our attachment to certain lenses, our attachment to certain ways of filtering reality will basically dictate how we understand everything and how we understand everyone and how we may be projecting different forms of judgments on whatever happens around us and be completely convinced that that's like that. It's how I'm thinking, I'm feeling, I'm perceiving, I'm concluding. And that will be problematic for sure, especially if you try to relate to someone else apart from you. That's that's in itself problematic for us, having that stance. What to speak when we extend that to others who may be thinking in the same way, in the different way, but from the same narrow-mindedness. So you put two of them together for 5 minutes in an elevator, and you have World War III there. So no surprise that we have this global conflicts around the world, which basically are just like a magnified expression of the micro conflicts we are having with ourselves, with one another, with me and two more and three. So individual, little group, big group, national, international, global, intergalactical conflict. It's never enough. So yeah, we should humble our views. And although we have some, how to say, I talked about that in the book on divine unknowing. We have certain knowledge that we have received that inform our life and practice, and we have some experiences and some certainty and faith, and that's great. But we should always remain with the door open to have our views and opinions challenged in a healthy way by circumstances, and to continue growing and expanding the way we are seeing it all, basically. Because Krishna himself is engaged in that exercise. So he's leading the way. Now, God himself is open to growth and evolution and development. And he's always discovering something new in Sri Radha and his devotees and vice versa. So there's always this willingness for rediscovery. So if we want to enter there, we are representing their department, we are expected to walk that talk as well. So anyhow, some few words regarding Bhakti Rasa's further reflection. So I'm seeing one message in the chat. Oh, okay. It was not a question. It was just Nam Dharma expressing that he had to leave. Thank you, Nam Dharma, for being present. So, something else? Any other question? So, Bhaktiraj has another question, or you have just forgot to take
Well,
your hat out?
I had a question that I brought with me. That
Okay.
wasn't in response,
Yeah, it
so
was not the other one was not a question, so yeah, it was a
no.
comment. Yeah, so
Yeah, I
yeah.
appreciate your further reflection on that, Maharaj. Thank you. So it's, I've been thinking about Tadatmya and what that means, and trying to really understand it in a personal way. And I'm kind of wondering if you could share your perspective on the, like a concept of inclusivity, what that means, and in your perspective, and what it is and what it isn't. Because I think, like you're saying, we hear these words and we get an idea about it, and we think that that's what it actually means. So I'm just kind of wondering if you could expand upon your perspective of what inclusivity is and what it is not.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate that. Yeah, as you emphasize, it's my perspective. It's not that I will speak about what inclusivity is and what is not, but I will share my perspective of what inclusivity is and what is not, which is my perspective today, February 10th, 2024. It can be updated, upgraded. So probably tomorrow, later today, there may be a different answer. Just in case, so you don't take me that seriously to that level. So inclusivity and the context of Tadatmya, well, yeah, inclusivity is a nice word. I really like it. But also, yeah, I remember we talked about that in the book when we were talking about exclusivity and inclusivity and how to relate with other people and how our particular tradition is, in one sense, very exclusive in the sense of it presents a very specific ideal, very detailed description of transcendence and the way we will be serving there. Everything is very, very exclusive, very specified. So, but if we are do not have a foundation of inclusivity, then the only exclusivity that will be there will be in the form of fundamentalism. My tradition is the best, and we are the highest, and this is the topmost things, and nobody else has that, and we just become fanatics. So that's exclusivity and toxic exclusivity. So to reach the actual exclusivity that Gaudiya Vaishnavism is all about, first you have to establish this inclusivity, which is, as if we want to put it in the terms of radical personalism, we spoke about non-dual thinking. First, let's establish this non-dual foundation, this commonality, where all of us share this interconnectedness, with the center of reality, and how other traditions are, how to say, sharing this common foundation as well. And on that basis, we can acknowledge and recognize the differences, the diversity, deal with that, appreciate that, try to nourish from that, but also in some cases, know, in some cases, know where to sit, locate ourselves in that context. In some cases, we may need to take some respectful distance, or we may realize that this is not my inner tribe or my inner circle, although there is a common non-dual foundation, but this is my tribe, and that's the other tribe, your tribe. Like when I introduced Tadatmya, we make this official inaugural talk.
Oops.
Refers to your inner group, your inner tribe, your inner circle. That's Swapaksha. There in Suhrit Paksha are those who are not in your inner circle, but you are friendly with. So you can work with them, you can collaborate with them, but they are not your inner circle. And it's okay. I mean, this is happening in eternity, in transcendence. So there is place for that. So what to speak here? And then there's the bipaksha, which is the, how to say, the opposing party, let's say. And I'm not saying with this they are the enemies that we have to destroy or something like that, but it's just a group of people that, for whatever reason, for whatever degree of differences in mood and opinion or whatever, we are not part of the inner circle with each other, and we cannot even work together or collaborate together because these differences come on the surface and everything becomes too complicated. So each one needs to find their place, and still we can appreciate each other from that distance, even we are not working or collaborating together, no. So I wouldn't call them enemies, although sometimes Vipaksha is translated as such, but in this context, it's just like some different group with which the differences are enough not to be able to work together. So in the context of Tadatmya and inclusivity, this also plays out in that connection. No, I mean, I mentioned in that talk, for some people, the notion of Tadatmya and the type of Sangha we are trying to conceive and build, Tadatmya will be their Swapaksha. There will be their innermost circle, so to say, their chosen tribe. And okay, that's great, as long as they are choosing that for the right reasons and with the proper understanding, because we can find everything. So as long as that's okay, and we have tried, and we will continue to try to make it clear for others and for ourselves what's Tadatmya and what's the foundation of that, which are the pillars of that, as we have talked about radical personalism and the seven pillars we shared. So some people may find, okay, Tadatmya is my tribe. Some other people may find, I like those guys, but I'm in a different ship. But I like them. I like to navigate close to them. So we can work together. We will, as I say, we will be carried by the same winds, but we will be on different boats, not on the same one. And it's okay. There is place for that as well. Why not? There should be place for that, not only in Tadatmya, there should be place for all the things everywhere. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And that's why Tadatmya, the idea of Tadatmya, the necessity, I will say, of Tadatmya came as a consequence of that. And then you have others who will think, I'm not in that same boat, and I'm not even carried by the same wind. So those situations will be placed in another way, in another place. And all that is is part of inclusivity. No, because everyone is given a place. Now, inclusivity doesn't mean make everyone part of your inner circle. That's not inclusivity. Inclusivity is give everyone their place. Do not deprive anyone from a place. That's actual inclusivity. No, exclusivity is the opposite. Exclusivity, fanatical exclusivity is only we are the whatever, only we are the correct ones and the safe ones, and everyone else is doomed forever. So you are not giving those other people any place. They have no place. They have no possibility of existing. They are sent to hell. So that's not inclusive. But inclusive, again, doesn't mean force yourself to have all, how to say, a whole bunch of people who are absolutely diverse in a situation where it's too much diversity for all of them to be part of the same inner circle. It can happen. So sometimes we have to be careful. I like inclusivity, and I'm all for our harmonizing differences and unity and diversity. I mean, I love all these ideas, but also I'm, how to say, I'm trying to remain sober enough as to remind myself that in practice, I mean, life happens, people happen, relationships happen, differences of opinion happen. And sometimes we are not able to harmonize everything or integrate everyone in this in the most perfect way or as part of an inner circle. And we shouldn't feel like tortured by that, no? Or we shouldn't feel, I mean, we should do our best for that to happen for sure. But if that's not happened despite that, we should also learn to be at peace with, okay, some people may need to be somewhere else. Or the other person may feel that. I'm not saying in both directions. Maybe to give you an example, because I have gone through that so many times. I remember in my teenage years as a devotee, I was so naive, and I still am, but I was even more. And I was put in a position of leadership having 20 something years. So you can imagine the result of that. I mean, no catastrophe, but it was stressing because also I was trying to have everyone inspired and to have everyone like, and I felt it's my duty that everyone is inspired. So if someone is not inspired, it's my fault. You can imagine what does it mean in the mind of a 20-something year naive brahmachari, close to neurosis. No. So I it never reached a critical point, but I really suffered a lot by lack of proper vision and proper guidance regarding having the proper vision that, hey, relax a little bit. No, the other people's choices are their choices, and it's not up to you to have the whole community fired up. No, it's also they have their role to play, and not everyone will fit in, belong to in this particular place and in this particular mood. So don't feel the pressure to have everyone absolutely in ecstasy with what you can offer in your limited capacity. So that's one thing. But also to the other person, the person who is trying to be part of the community or the group and is not feeling, and is feeling, this is not my place. I'm not as inspired as I would like. And that person also can enter a guilt trip feeling, I must be doing something wrong because I'm not being part. I'm not being inspired. I must be committing some offense because if not, I will be totally part of it. And maybe it has nothing to do with that. It's just like, that's not your boat. Maybe you can be in a relatively close boat and still be connected, but you need your boat or you need your tribe, whatever term you want to use. So my point is that by learning these things, we can save ourselves from lots of anxiety and stress and unnecessary even projections on others, on ourselves. So I'm saying this because also, yes, I want to be realistic with the whole Tathagata project. It's not that I've shared the news and I'm like having some over expectation, like everyone will join. No, I'm sure that won't happen. Second, whoever joins will remain forever hyper excited. Probably that won't happen either. I mean, it's not that I don't want that, but just to be realistic. So I'm saying that just to settle those things as humanly as possible. I'm willing to be there so whomever feels inspired remains inspired. I also need that. But also I'm willing to be realistic, no? That some dynamics may happen, which some people may feel this is not my place. I've tried, it's not working. And it's perfectly fine, if provided it's for good reasons. Because again, some people may feel inspired for the wrong reasons, and some people may feel uninspired for the wrong reasons. And some people may feel inspired and uninspired for the right reasons. So everything can happen. So provided we are doing things for the right reasons and we are being sincere and introspective, whether it is joining or taking some healthy distance, that's welcomed if it comes from a genuine place. And for me, that's inclusivity. You know, like allow those things to happen and allow everyone to feel those things, to accept those things, to be included in their experience. Not so much necessarily to be included in the inner circle, but to be included in terms of I'm acknowledging what you're experiencing, and that has a place somewhere. Maybe it's not here, but it has to have a place. To begin with, it has a place because it's going on, it's happening, it exists. So it has a place. And second, it needs a place for it to be further expressed and nourished. It may be the Tathagata space, Tathagata Sangha, or it may be another Sangha. That's secondary for me. For me, the important thing is how that experience is being given place and how whatever one is experiences is nourished. So for me, that's a criterion of of inclusivity. No, so we don't kind of develop some like over idealistic, naive, romantic idea like, no, let everyone join him and everyone has to be here and inspire and have their place. Sometimes in time we will feel okay, there is a certain, as I say, the Dadaism has been founded, so to say, on the foundation of radical personalism and those seven pillars and a certain understanding of those things. And in time, for some people, it may prove that they have, I mean, they may agree with the idea, but they may have a different understanding of those things or a different mood, and they may require their own place and space for that. And it's okay. I mean, again, this is not any dictatorship where anyone is like forced to remain in a certain place. And also, we are not expected to force anyone to to do things according to how we want things to happen, no? So, and of course, these social dynamics can be sometimes complex because people, we are complex. We are different. We have different opinions and views and feelings and ways of doing things. But we have to be at least careful, humble enough, respectful enough to respect that the way I feel things are better are not necessarily the best for everyone. No, my criteria of better is not necessarily of universal application. It may be what works for me better, what inspires me the most, or what inspires people of my nature or species the most, and that's great. But probably some other person doesn't need that, and that's okay. We should give space for that, and we should be very careful in relating to one another from that place of basic humility and respect, no? And that, again, that's tadadmia, because tadadmia means empathy and or identification. So we need to take the time to identify with the experience of the other person, respect that, empathize with that, which doesn't mean I'm canceling my own individuality and everything will happen according to the other's need, because that becomes a whole, I mean, whole hodgepodge, as they say, no? Whatever is someone's need today, that's what we become. No? And we lose sight of there is an actual foundation to Tadatmya, that's how what we want it to be, so to say, and on that foundation to build it. So it's important that we keep that foundation in place, and on that basis, there is inclusivity in that particular context, so to say. So Tadatmya can be something, because if not, it will become anything and everything at any given moment, and it's nothing at the end of the day. So that can happen also, no? And I know that that has been a fear. I've talked with some devotees who have expressed that, no? Because if you make like a very open invitation, as I did with Tadatmya, and people from other sanghas can join, and if you feel aligned, you can come and make your country. Some were like, oh, but we are afraid that so many people from different places may come, and that will become everything and anything at the same time. Because, and I can understand the potential risk of that, and that's why also, while offering that openness, I tried to also express this. I was inclusive in that sense, but also I tried to be exclusive in the sense of, okay, but this is founded on the foundation of radical personalism, these seven pillars. And a particular approach to the seven pillars that was presented in the book. So there are certain rules to the game, so to say. Because if there are no rules and anything and everything goes, there's no game. No. If I tell you, okay, let's play football. Okay, so how do we play football? Oh, you do whatever you want with the ball. And someone will take the ball with the hand and will run away and jump into a lake and start to swim. And it's like, you say, that's not football, but you told me I can do whatever I want. No, there are certain, there has to be some rules that facilitate the game, the interaction, the expression. So anyhow, that's those are some thoughts regarding inclusivity in terms of Tadadmi. Again, clarifying, yeah, inclusivity doesn't mean that everyone has to fit in one same place, so to say, but we should be able to give everyone their place. And have been mature enough to acknowledge when, in some cases, someone's place, maybe our own, maybe somewhere else, whether in terms of tadadmia or whether in so many terms, again, in so many ways, we have to be willing to that and not feel that's necessarily a problem. provided we have arrived to that place from a place of introspection, prayer, and honesty. If that's the case, we have all reasons to celebrate the arrival to that particular place. I hope that helps. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that was beautiful. Thank you. Of course, a radical personalist kind of answer. So that was great. And it
okay.
does really seem to tie into, you know, individuation and that in context with all the other pillars. So, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, Maharaj.
Thank you. Thank you. So, what else? Karuneshwar is raising her hand. Yeah, I'm just, 1 second. I'm checking the battery of my computer because it's not charged. But I started 100%, but I'm 39 now, so it's being consumed pretty fast. So still we can go on, but if you just see me running, I just went for the charger, just to clarify. Yes, Karuneshwari, Param, nice to see you.
Hare Krishna. In one way, I feel like this is a question that maybe I would have asked when I joined, you know, like 30 odd years ago, but I'm asking it again now because it feels like I need to ask it again now because last
we
few
are
years,
still joining.
Yeah, because the last few years, I feel I have to like really understand things properly, why I'm doing things. And in the beginning, maybe I was accepting them more because Krishna consciousness seems to work. There's some taste. So therefore, just accept everything. So the question I'm asking now, maybe I'll give a little example of something first, and then it's quite a specific question. So for example, there's a temple community that I'm kind of, you know, connected with, and it has quite a new committee. And the committee made some decisions that a lot of devotees were not so sure about. So I spoke to one of the members because I know her and I, you know, brought this up. And her answer was, everyone on this committee is chanting their 16 runs. And between the, you know, the combined years of devotional service is several hundred years. So the implication was because of this, the decision is correct. So I suppose my specific question is, how, because different people have different natures, some people are more sadhakas than others. So how much of someone's advancement in Krishna consciousness is based on a specific number? How much of it is based on following a vow that you made and honoring that? And how much of it can just be that someone is offering what they can offer, whether it's sadhana-wise or service-wise, from the heart on a particular day according to their ability, capacity, inspiration? How important are the vows? How important is this magical 16 number?
Mm.
Is it, if someone does 13 or 14 instead of 16 on a day, is that a massive setback for their advancement? Those are the questions.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, Karuneshwari, I think you already know the answer to your question. But of course, sometimes we need some further confirmation. So let's further pound the post, so to say. You already know the answer to your question yourself, I will say, and you already, I imagine, know what's my answer to that question because we have talked about that a few times. And of course, I don't know who gave that answer, and I don't know the person, so this is nothing personal toward them, although I like to be radically personal, but in this case, I cannot be because I don't know them, and I have nothing against them, but yeah, I personally do not agree with that. I do not agree that a number warrants quantity, warrants quality. That doesn't happen. We already, I mean, it's okay. We can talk about this every single time we need to talk over and over again because there's other things that seem to be quite a big misunderstanding in different places or circles that, as you said, if I chant this number for this number of rounds for this number of years, you just bring the calculator, please, and reach the final. The conclusion is reached with a calculator in this case. So what's your stance, internal stance in Krishna consciousness? Just bring a calculator. How many years you have, how many years you are devoted, how many years rounds you chanted, it gives this final number. This is who you are in terms of Adhikar. This, you have this number. No. But tell me, where in the scripture that's declared? Now, where is that? Is the yardstick to measure where you are internally? On the contrary, and there's this verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'm sorry not to recall the exact section and verse. We can find it if you want, but it's there, which basically says you can be chanting for a million lifetimes and not attain Krishna Prem if you are not chanting with the proper spirit. So it's a way of saying, now, million lifetimes, I mean, bring the calculator. How many rounds? Just 16 rounds and 764. I mean, nobody cares for a number. Krishna is not a mathematician. I always say that. He's pretty bad at math. He has unconditional love for everyone indiscriminately without whatever we are doing, we are chanting or not. So he's not calculating. No? So he's not requesting a number. I know Prabhupada requested a number, and hopefully my answer here doesn't sound again like now I'm downplaying chanting 16 rounds and downplaying Prabhupada because of that. I'm not saying that. No. And Prabhupada, as I always say, first requested 64 rounds. So, and I'm not saying with that, when you chant 64 rounds, then you have everything warranted. Because again, it's not the number, it's the quality. For in terms time, place, and circumstance, different numbers may be required. But the assumption is the numbers are accompanied by an inner spirit. As I think I told you some time ago, or maybe I talked with someone privately, I don't know. But I this is something confidential that I was shared, but so I won't give names, but I was talking with some Vaishnavas, and they were telling me from a Gaudiya lineage, not ISKCON, but other lineage, where 16 rounds is not like standard, so to say. And they were sharing how their guru chanted one round per day, and at the end of their life, of the lifetime of that guru realized Siddha Swarup, spiritual body. And again, with this, I'm not saying start chanting one round from now on. You can get it, but try to get my point. No, it's not about the number; it's about the quality. As I like to say sometimes, probably Rupa Goswami didn't chant 16 rounds per day. Probably not more than that. Probably he chant half a syllable and pass out. Those were his daily rounds. So will you go to him and say, how many rounds are you chanting, Rupa Goswami? Half a syllable? Wow, you're so blooped. No? We are chanting thousands of rounds to get to that half a syllable that Rupa Goswami will be chanting, to that quality of half a syllable that has the potential to give you everything. So you have these statements in Shastra. On one side, even if you have, if you chant half a syllable of the name, you can attain all perfection by half a syllable. But on the other side, you can chant for millions of lifetimes and not attain divine love. So you try to put everything on the scale. Just once, half a syllable, but with a proper attitude, with full attention, without any apparat and so on, everything is coming. Without the proper attitude, without proper spirit, no matter how big is how many zeros does your calculator have, you are not attaining it. So I think it's very important to emphasize that, because if not, we just how to say, take for granted things on the basis of externals. Like today, also one devotee told me that. Anyhow, again, no need to go into the details, but that I was invited to a place, but I was not invited to talk at certain temples because I was not a member of a certain institution and all these external things. Now, if you will be member of officially affiliated with the institution, you can talk probably, but since you are not, you cannot. And he will tell me, but Maharaj, here there are devotees who are pedophiles and are walking along and even giving classes, but since they are affiliated with the institution, and some of them are senior devotees or proper disciples, that's okay, no problem. So my point is, the problem with this is that we develop a whole new system to ascertain to ascertain the eligibility of every person, which is not based on sincerity, internal realization, but of institutional affiliation, or just being a disciple of certain guru. Which, of course, you are a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, jai, great. But I don't know where you are internally. I mean, you can be a disciple of Srila Prabhupada and be totally crazy. There were many of those. And I'm not downplaying Srila Prabhupada, and I'm not condemning those disciples. I'm just saying, I mean, it's not enough to show your affiliation card, so to say. No, your own example has to shine for itself. I mean, that's what it takes. It's not just, but my guru is such a person, but I'm affiliated here, or but I've reached this number today. But the question will be, from which place you are doing all that? Internally, where are you internally when chanting? Where are you internally when being part of a certain institution? Where are you internally as a disciple of that particular guru? That's their actual question that will be considered, that will be put on the scale at the end of the day. If we develop another yardstick, another system of measuring things, that's a way of cheating ourselves, basically. Because we will cheat ourselves thinking, oh, I'm just by reaching this number, I'm saved. That I don't, it doesn't care, doesn't matter the quality. I just have to reach the number. If I'm affiliated with this group, I'm saved. I belong to the elite. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. I'm just, I have the card, the membership card. Now, if I'm a disciple of this guru, that's it. I mean, he's a pure devotee, so I don't need to be a pure devotee. He's a pure devotee. So he's so merciful that he will make me a pure devotee, even if I don't care at all for that. So we develop our whole system of measuring things or understanding reality, but that's not correct, basically. Again, I'm not conducting any campaign against specific individuals nor institutions, just trying to hopefully address the things with basic common sense. I don't think I'm bringing here any extraordinary topics. I don't think I'm like, how to say, exhibiting my utmost limit of brilliance to conclude what I'm saying. I mean, for me, it's really basic common sense. No, like, I mean, I know many people who chant 16 rounds, and we don't have to speak about anyone else. Just be honest about ourselves. When we chant 16 rounds, are those 16 rounds chanted, all of them, from a purely perfect, clear, Krishna conscious, absorbed place? Probably not. So there are better rounds, less worse rounds, and ideally we have to chant from a better place. So I think that has to be brought to the table, because if not, unfortunately, and as example you shared speaks also with all respect for all the parts involved, sometimes we can use this new measuring system also to cancel further conversations, no? Someone may have a difference of opinion or something, and the reply to that is, as you mentioned, that person is chanting his 16 rounds, so there's nothing you have to say here. But you can say, well, but am I also chanting my 16 rounds? I have some word to say in this regard. So to say, again, it's not that you have to bring the number to have a right to express yourself. That's also the point. So, yeah, I think it's important not to be so reductionistic. Like, Maharaj, how many rounds have you chanted? Oh, not 16, so we cannot talk to you, sorry. Or whatever, no? I mean, someone may be chanting less than 16 and have more important things to say. Again, it's not the number. We shouldn't scan the person. You are reducing the person to a number, basically. For me, that's another form of impersonalism. I don't care for you as an individual and your inner experience. Just give me the number. Are you a 16 or not? So to say. No? The Enneagram have from 1 to 9. We have our 16-neagram. So are you a 16 or not? Yeah, I'm a 16. Okay. You can say something. Or even worse, nobody can tell you anything because you are 16. So you are completely protected, so to say, from any criticism. And if on top of that, you are again, you are an elder, devotee, or a proper disciple, or whatever administrative post you have, you are more immune to criticism. And that's not healthy. I mean, the more senior you are, the more you should be willing to receive healthy criticism. So you remain sober in that position of leadership and seniorship. The higher you go, the more you should be praying for healthy, constructive criticism, and the more you will be willing to hear others' opinion and not cancel culture. So yeah, that's what I can say. The rest is, well, each of us choose how to deal with that situation, because of course we chose to be in that situation. I mean, we didn't choose to receive that answer, but we choose to be in a particular serving in a particular place and circle, and it's okay, it's perfect. And every choice we make in those cases, of course, entails some further ripples and waves and movements that are part of the initial choice, which is again okay, but yeah, invite us to learn to further navigate those waters. So yeah, I mean, dialogue is the a communication is the hope of the world, so to say. Now we shouldn't cancel conversations and dialogue, especially if I don't know, if significant members of a community, like I'm sure you are, want to have some feelings or emotions or opinions. I mean, those have to be given a voice. There has to be a place for those things to be properly shared and voiced, and not like canceled just on the strength of a number coming from another person without any consideration of inner quality. Because again, at the end, the whole thing is reduced to a formula, magical formula, which is just a number. Give me the number and you're in. Give me a number and it's, yeah, I don't want to use strong words, but for me, it's a lack of respect toward Bhakti itself to do that, to reduce the whole process and the whole giving of one hearts to just give me the number. I mean, giving a number is relatively easy. You can even cheat about the number. You can maybe not even chanting your 16 rounds, but you say you're chanting that, and that's it. No, you're in. And I know people do that because of fear of others knowing they are not doing that, because of the perks that come by being in the 16 club, so to say. And that's like very gross misrepresentation of what bhakti should be, like a vibrant, passionate, essential experience, just reducing it to a number and everything depends on putting the proper password, the proper number in the password, so to say, to get access to being able to speak or be heard or whatever. So again, I'm not with this, I'm not pointing at any person. I'm just saying it's important to re-examine how we deal with these ideas of vows and commitments, not only because of the number and with the chanting of rounds, but with everything. We commit to some things. That's a whole different conversation in itself, and I won't go in detail here, but I've been talking here with a friend of mine. This idea of vows, you know, that we make a sometimes lifelong vow from a certain place and moment in our life, and how much we really need to push lifelong vows that are taken in a place in our life that is so different after a few years after. And how flexible we should be to not break the vow, but just adjust the vow and as life goes on. You follow my point? Because you can commit to something for your whole life when you are, I don't know, 16, 17, and you have a certain framework. But after 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you are an absolutely different person. And you may need to break the vow to follow the vow more substantially from another place, so to say. Try to get my point. I'm not here promoting just do every crazy thing. But I'm just saying we commit to some vows even for our whole life from a certain place. And in time, we find ourselves from in so many different places. So what to do with those vows and those commitments from the other different places we are in? How to deal with that? Sometimes we do not talk too much about that. It's just you committed to that vow that day and you keep doing that till you die, so to say, without too much nuance. And for me, that's a variety of what Rupa Goswami calls Niyamagraha. As you say in the fourth, no, so second verse, Upadeshamrita, he says six things to ruin your bhakti, basically. One of them is Niyamagraha, and one of the meanings of Niyamagraha is to do follow rules, regulations, to do stuff without knowing why you are doing it. So this is something like that. We embrace a vow, and in time we continue doing it, but no longer with the proper intention or motivation, just mechanically because I committed to that 30 years ago. But I need to discover a new place and a new way to continue doing that thing. If I'm not doing that renewal process of rediscovering my vows, that's Niyamagraha. And that's damaging one's bhakti, Rupa Goswami is saying. So it's important that we are not promoting Niyamagraha in the name of bhakti, in the name of being loyal or case or follower. We are not promoting that people just sticks to a number or to a rule without further thought to it. And in one way, in time, they start to follow that without any reason or for the wrong reason sometimes. So, yes, and we should be talking about that. Jamuna, your hand is trembling for so long being raised there. So please, your turn.
Hi, Krishna. So on the topic of vows, but then we hear about, you know, Haridas Thakur, when he was near the end of his life, he, you know, he was struggling to fulfill his vows of his chanting. And even Lord Chaitanya told him to stop, but he still was determined to continue on with his vow. So we are told this again and again and again of how important it is to stick to our vow no matter what, which then for me personally, I feel incredibly guilty if for some reason I'm not able to chant 16 rounds because, well, look at me, I'm not even chanting a pinprick of what Haridas Thakur did. And also then there's the point of we should have, if you have so much taste for chanting that you don't just want to stop at 16, you want to continue chanting as many as possible. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, of course, we have the example of Haridas Thakur regarding the bow, and you are mentioning your own example. But I will say again, sorry to repeat that, but we speak about the bow. But what's the bow? The bow is not to chant 16 rounds. The bow is to chant 16 rounds of Shuddhanam. Ultimately, to try it. Because if not, I could just chant Nama Parad and be completely careless. But I'm doing my bow of the 16 rounds. But the spirit of the commitment is not the number. Of course, there is a number. I'm not condemning that. I'm not inviting you to chant less. I'm just saying that we can become over, how to say, we can over-identify the bow with the number, that we stop paying attention to the actual spirit of the bow, the actual spirit of the rule, which is not the number, which is chanting with such right attitude, as you mentioned, that at one point you end up transgressing the number in the sense that you start to chant more. Because you can also say, oh, you are chanting more than 16. You are not following the vow. You committed yourself to chant 16. So you are breaking your vow, Jamuna. You are chanting 17 today. And you will say, no. I mean, the idea is that I got it. The idea is that I got a taste. Okay, that's the vow. That's the point. The idea is that I chant from such a place that I will chant more and more. Okay, so that's the vow, to chant from such a place that at one point you will chant even more than 16. I'm not here promoting chant less and less. They just chant more and more. But the only way you will chant more and more, as you mentioned, is by getting a taste. And the only way you will get a taste is to chant from a certain place in the context of the number we committed to. But that's not the all in all of the vow. That's my point. Do not reduce your vow to how many rounds you committed to chant. That's an aspect of the vow. But it's not the all in all. It's to chant from a certain place, like we also mentioned. You have the four regulative principles. One of them sometimes is presented as no meat eating. That's not the all in all of the vow. That's an aspect of the vow. The actual principle is be as compassionate, as kind as you can. And one aspect of that is no meat eating. No, naturally. So similarly, one aspect of the bow is the number, the numeric aspect of the bow. Let's call it like that. No? Every bow is a numeric aspect of a bow. But, and I know some people, we are more about sometimes numbers and fixed. It's easier. No? I'm reaching the number, that's it. Like I remember once a devotee told me, Maharaj, whenever I'm not chanting, I don't reach to chant my 16 rounds, I know that I lost my day and I've been in Maya. And I was thinking inside, and whatever you chant the 16 rounds, what do you feel? You feel you have transcended Maya and everything is divine? No, it's a little bit white, black and white criterion. So yeah, of course, Haridas Thakur was singing, chanting his 3 lakhs per day with perfect, pure Christian consciousness, and he wanted to chant even more. I don't think that Haridas Thakur reached his round 192, and he was like, okay, I'm done for today. No? Probably he chanted even more than that. So again, I get your point, and I hope I'm not being misread that, okay, Maharaj doesn't care for any number. And no. The number is established with one's guru. Different Gaudiya groups will have different approaches to that. So I think that's also important to bear in mind. And we have different, again, cases of devotees. So I think that attaining perfection, chanting less, chanting more than 16, we have all these different possibilities. So we should remain open to that. But also, okay, yes, I have my own particular commitment to my guru in this connection. So I will say the main thing here is the commitment to a guru, but the commitment again. The guru is not just expecting that you chant 16 rounds of Nama Parat. The guru wants you to chant 16 rounds of Nam Shuddhanam. Of course, you may not be able to do that from day one, but that's where the vow points to. So as long, and we should have this present in our mind. That's my point. When we are chanting, the spirit behind my chanting today shouldn't be, I have to finish my 16 rounds. That's not correct. Sorry. That won't take to the type of chanting your guru wants you to reach. The spirit of the chanting is, I want to get closer and closer to chant Sudanam. And I will address my chanting from that place. And I've committed to chant 16 rounds. That comes after. There are priorities. The priority is not chant 16 rounds. The priority is chant from the proper place your 16 rounds. Again, it's an emphasis, it's a nuance, it's a priority thing. It's part of the vow, but it's in the numeric side of the vow. That's not the substantial side, because if not, again, and I'm sure you will tell me, you've seen some cases that you have devotees who are just counting, not chanting. They're just thinking about reaching the number, finishing the chanting, not continuing. They are just concerned about reaching the number. And they, again, as we were talking, extend this idea of social weight, so to say, social influence, according to if you reach the number of not, without caring what's the quality of your chanting, just give me the number. So, and I've seen that a lot. I'm not saying I'm totally free from that. So I'm saying this again without pointing to any specific group, just to a pattern of thought. And I'm just pointing to, again, if we have seen that a lot, that means that many of us very easily slip into that way of interpreting this this idea of 16 as the main aspect of my Tao, and we just become obsessed with the number, losing sight of the actual spirit. Or as you said, if for whatever reason I was not able to chant my 16 rounds, if there's any real reason, you go into a neurotic trip, which shouldn't be the case. If there's some real reason, I mean, I don't know, your house got burned or some burned down or some extreme emergency. Again, I'm not inviting here to find lofty excuses to neglect our sadhana, but and you cannot be, I mean, you have to be saving the life of your family in the burning down house. You cannot be just like, I don't know if, I mean, I have to save my family, but if I do so, I'm not sure if I will finish my 16 rounds. please. So I'm giving an extreme example, but sometimes we are equally extreme in relating to the things, no? So yeah, the number 16 for some is part of the vow, but it's not the whole of the vow. Every vow, every rule has a spirit. As they speak, the spirit of the law. So the law is there, the number is there, but the spirit has to be there even.
There is a comment in the chat, Maharaj.
There's a comment in the chat. Okay.
By Scarlett.
There are many comments. Which one?
There's one by Scarlett.
Okay. My dear friends, perhaps I own the little boat that is sailing in your stream. My tradition does not chant at all, yet my love for the divine source of all grows greater and my heart rests in peace. Interesting discussion. Thank you for permitting to me to listen, your Christian sister. Thank you, Scarlett. Nice to see you joining. She's a friend of mine from New Jersey. She's a Christian pastor. So, yeah, again, as I said, and again, this is not an anti-chanting campaign, but Parikshit Maharaj reached perfection listening to Bhagavatam. He chanted zero rounds during that whole last week. So again, I'm not saying follow him because we had our own commitment, but I'm just saying let's be open to all these possibilities so we don't develop a toxic sense of certainty that because I'm finishing my number, I'm necessarily on the other side of the rainbow, so to say. And again, every bow, whether it's 16 rounds, whether it's four regulative principle, whether it's whatever, any bow, there are different bows and commitments. I think it's important that we are able to go beyond the formal aspect of the bow or the numeric aspect of the bow and reach deeper and deeper aspects of that. No? We have to renew our bows on a daily basis, I will say. What does it mean for me to chant 16 rounds today? What does it mean for me to be a celibate monk today? What does it mean for me to accept, to follow the four recs today? What does it mean? From which place I'm relating to that? It's just copy-paste formula? No, hopefully not. So yeah, thank you so much, Jamuna, for your question and thoughts. And also for those who will like, at the beginning, Bhakti Rasa shared the verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, chapter 8, verses 29-30. That says, if one chants the exalted holy name of the Lord again and again, and yet his love for the Supreme Lord does not develop and tears do not appear in his eyes, it is evident that because of his offenses in chanting, the seed of the holy name of Krishna does not sprout. But if one only chants with some slight faith the holy names of Lord Chaitanya Nityananda, very quickly he is cleansed of all offenses. Thus, as soon as he chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, he feels the ecstasy of love of God. Thank you. So yeah, those were the references. And again, I know that with some of these ideas, we may be like squishing some ways that we were used to conceive certain things. And sometimes we may feel even unconsciously like, not attacked, but like, or challenged, but like, it's a different way of speaking about the same thing or a different approach. I'm not saying it's better. I'm just saying, it's what it is. and I appreciate your patience in trying to process all the things and deal with all the things. I mean, I myself, I'm in that same process. I mean, all of us have been practicing, some of you for longer than me, for 4 or 5 decades. I've been practicing for 2.5 decades. And I mean, let's be honest, all of us have our own prejudices or ways that we learn about doing things or conceptions or ways of thinking about things, some scars, and they become ingrained, and we have to be compassionate with ourselves and each other in understanding those processes and being patient in opening ourselves to new ways of thinking, not because those were necessarily wrong, but just because there are always new ways and deeper ways to continue unfolding the things, as we say in the beginning. Krishna consciousness is a bottomless ocean that always acquire deeper and deeper meanings and ways to be approached. There is not one single way, only legal way to be a devotee. It's unlimited. So I know it's a tapasya to enter that space, no? And to challenge our own thoughts and opinions without having our faith going through extreme crisis, so to say. No, and I'm feeling, no, this is helping me. This is making everything more nuanced. This is nourishing my faith. At the same time, it's challenging it, but to grow, challenging to grow deeper. Hopefully, that's the idea. And of course, if we are not having that experience, there's always place to share and to talk, because that's it, the only intention of this meeting and spaces, that we can continue growing together in faith, and in how we conceive everything around us, and how we practice on the basis of that conception, bringing a fruit, an ideal fruit as a result. So thank you so much. And I think we may be able to conclude here today. We are almost 2 hours. Wow. And my battery is running off in a few minutes. So before that happens, we will close the curtain. Thank you so much to all of you for your time and presence and questions. And see you next Saturday, same time, same channel, and so on. And happy Advaita Saptami. I think it will be on Thursday, at least in Argentina. So may you have a very happy celebration of the appearance day of Sri Advaita Charya. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Advaita Charya ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru Kripa Sindhu Pyai Vacha Patitanam Pavani Pyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Gaur Hari Bol. Did you stop?